Peter was rocking out this morning. What a great way to end that show. Moving on, next is the West Marin Naturalist Hour with myself, Liz Wilhelm, and Dallas Smith. Seamus is out today. But if you're just tuning in, you are listening to KWMR 90.5 in Point Reyes Station, 89.9 in Bolinas, and 92.3 in the San Geronimo Valley. And we have a couple underwriting things here. KWMR is underwritten by Hydron Meadery, serving dry, naturally sparkling varietal honey wines and picnic sundries in a working farm atmosphere. More info at hydronmeadery.com. And also, KWMR is underwritten by the Inverness Park Market and Taproom, serving the folks of West Marin for over 40 years. More information at invernessparkmarket.com.
All right.
Good morning, and we're going to take it away with a...
Yeah, before we jump in, let's throw a little intro here.
A little intro song here, coming right at you.
Love that intro. I want to give a little shout out to Seamus for putting that intro together. It's all made with sounds from wildlife you can hear out on the seashore. So maybe next time you're listening, see how many you can pick out.
I know. So he's so talented.
He really is.
All right. So today we're actually playing a evergreen episode, so to speak, with the California White Shark Project. They have a couple events coming up. One here in Mill Valley and the other down in Half Moon Bay. This episode that we're going to play is from a couple years ago, kind of when they were first getting started, which is super cool to see that they're still thriving and doing really great work out there cataloging the white sharks off the California coast. So shout out to Scott and Paul and their whole team.
Yeah, that aired in December 12th of 2022. So, and we had been wanting to get Scott on for a really long time, so it's a really exciting episode. I think you and I had called in from somewhere on the beach from far away, so it's a fun episode. Before we jump into that, though, let's kind of get into our weather and our tides.
Because there's some stuff to talk about
there. We've got some stuff going on. We have some more September rains coming up here in our future, and it looks like it's more than just a slight drizzle. It looks like... pretty much rain through Wednesday night with a chance on Tuesday and Wednesday of up to a quarter inch on both days. So,
woo-hoo!
Right, possibly up to a half an inch if all of these things materialize. So now it's a good time to be able to make sure you got your rain gear, your everything's all buttoned up and ready for that first rain.
Put the outdoor cushions away.
Yes, totally, exactly. Get ready for it. But then it looks like pretty much from Thursday through the rest of the week, it'll be sunny.
Oh, nice.
And pretty warm through about highs of almost 70 degrees. And for tides today in Marshall, California, it's actually, we have another one of those interesting tides. Our last high tide was 3.5 feet at 8:20, and our next low tide is actually higher than our last high tide. It's going to be 3.7 feet at 12:28 p.m., and the next high tide after that is 4.5 feet at 5:25.
It's like leap year for the tides.
Yeah, it's kind of odd.
Evening themselves out. So basically, it's like... slack tide all day.
All day.
Which is kind of cool. It's a nice day for paddling.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really beautiful out there.
Yes,
and hopefully a little less smoky. Those fires were definitely, I was feeling it being out on the bay this weekend. But anywho.
Yeah, let's jump into the episode here.
Let's do it.
All right. Yeah, our guest today is Scott Anderson. You all probably know him. He's a local fella, and he is with the California White Shark Project. He has been working and like tagging and monitoring the white sharks out at the Farallon since 1987. So he graduated with a degree in environmental studies and then volunteered at the Farallons, which is a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Refuge. His passion for sharks led him into a lifelong study of white sharks that aggregate there in dense numbers. And he spotted and documented predation events from the island and developed the use of decoys, which are seal-shaped, with video cameras mounted underneath to film the sharks. And then he recognized that the white shark individuals could be identified by their markings, including the dorsal fin notches. In 1993, Scott's video was used in a production for BBC documentary called Great White Shark, for which he received an Emmy Award for the individual achievement and craft of cinematographers. He later teamed up with Stanford to deploy the first PSAT satellite tags, which led to the discovery of the white shark migration to the White Shark Cafe, which I can't wait to talk about in the show. And the research continues. And it's actually one of the we've talked about long-term data sets a lot on the show, and it's the longest running white shark monitoring program in existence. So that's who our guest is today.
All right. Can you hear us all right there, Scott?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. You're loud and clear.
Oh, yay.
Yay.
Right.
All right.
Great.
And
good to hear.
Yeah, we are very delighted to have you. We've been trying to get you on for the good part of a year. And Dallas. And Dallas said you're as elusive as the sharks you research.
Yeah, we're trying to change that. Yeah, we're working on being more out there.
Oh, it's all good. We are stoked to have you.
Cool.
So where do we start? Let's learn a little bit about the white sharks. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I think we should start with the name. I mean, everyone knows them as great white sharks, but you guys, the California White Shark Project. Can you expound a little more on that?
Yeah, so we're trying to keep this project, rooted in the scientific literature and stuff like that. And the common name for white shark is white shark. Carcharodon carcharias is technically a white shark. And there is no lesser white shark, so unless they come up with one, there's really no reason to call it a great white shark. But it's sort of it's one of those things, even that show I worked on in 1994, it was called Great White Shark. And it's just one of those things that, I don't know, it's become so common in the language that actually some scientific papers are publishing now, Great White Shark. So I don't know if it's going to ever change back, but we do have to explain it quite a bit.
And great is pretty accurate because they are large animals.
Yes, they're very impressive. They're very large. They get to be very large. Yeah. I mean, they're born about 4.5 feet, around 40 pounds, and a mouthful of teeth. And they feed on fish and stuff when they're small. And then eventually they migrate over to feeding on marine mammals, things like seals and sea lions, and then things like dead whales even. And so their diet changes and their teeth get bigger and their bodies get huge. And they're actually an endotherm, so they're actually able to maintain a body temperature and stay warm. So they're like a warm-blooded animal. Their body temperature, the core is like 76 degrees, and they're swimming around out there in 55-degree water and stuff like that. So they're a highly evolved, efficient predator, and they basically just put in a lot of time in these areas waiting for a seal to make the wrong move, and then they feed on them.
When you say they're highly evolved, I remember seeing something that they're actually older than the dinosaurs. Is that accurate?
Yeah, sharks go back, I think 350 million years or something like that, way, way, way back. The sharks that are here today don't look like the sharks back then.
Gotcha.
But they have the same characteristics of cartilage, structure, and then, instead of scales, they have these dermal denticles, the skin teeth. And that's actually how the teeth evolved into the mouth, where went from the skin into the mouth. And then they've got a pretty impressive array of teeth these days. And the white shark is unique in that it's also, like I said, it's an endotherm. That whole group of sharks, the mackerel sharks or laminids, that would be makos, salmon sharks, white sharks, those are all endotherms, are all warm-blooded. And so they work at a sort of a really high rate of ability when they're going. They can swim really fast, and they can think really quick, and things like that that warm-blooded animals can. And then that gives them an advantage in this cold water environment for catching things like seals and sea lions.
Wow. I never heard that term before, endotherm. So, like, that's their teeth grow out of their skin? Is that
what? Well, that's – okay, so that's a separate thing. So that's
two things.
Yeah, so the dermal denticles are these little tiny – you know, if you touch a shark's skin and go backwards, it's like sandpaper. It's really, really rough.
Oh.
And there's millions of these tiny little teeth that cover them instead of scales. And so they actually, in the evolution of sharks, eventually became what we know as the teeth in the jaw. And, you know, that's how they – evolved anyway.
Okay.
But the main thing is that their, you know, characteristics are really, really, really primitive, but the things that they've evolved since then, especially in a white shark, being warm-blooded, giving live birth.
They do give live birth.
Yeah, they give live birth, yeah. Anywhere from 7 to 9 pups at a time, and it probably only happens maybe once every 3 years or so.
Okay.
If there is a schedule, but it's a and those young have to survive, you know. So actually, it's different than, let's say, something like a cod or a lingcod or something like that that lays, you know, 50 million eggs. And if there's a good survival rate of those eggs, the population can grow quickly. But with something like a white shark or when they have few babies, there's just no way they can, you know, quickly come back from, let's say, being depleted.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
keep them coming.
Oh yeah. Oh, we got it. We have hordes of questions. And by the way, I should mention that Liz and I, a little bit pre-pandemic, went to a presentation you did at the National Seashore, which was absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
At the Red Barn there, and so I definitely have. I know we have a lot of questions that derive from that. But how often do they eat? So, like, if they're warm-blooded, they must have to, you know, keep a metabolism going that...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so there's a little bit of an expense there to maintain a body temperature. But part of the reason... So there's another term, which I'll throw out there, is called a gigantotherm. And that would be like a whale shark. Whale sharks don't really have an ability to recycle the heat back into the core of their body. But because they're so big, that just the fact that they're swimming generates some heat. And so they actually are a little bit warmer than the water, but it goes up and down with the water temperature.
Interesting.
Yeah, so the thing about white sharks, really, they don't do a lot that takes a lot of energy. They swim at, like, the same speed all the time, and they're just looking around. And so when they do actually find a seal, they rush up and bite it, and then there's some exertion in, you know, feeding on it, but it's really... That's the only time they ever really exert themselves. Otherwise, they just swim at the same speed, sort of, I wouldn't say chilling, but they're not using a lot of energy. So they're pretty efficient. If you look at their body shape and everything, they really, you couldn't design something better to go through the water, really.
Hmm. Is it true that sharks have to keep moving?
Of a myth. That's a great question. And actually, the oceanic sharks, like white sharks and makos and things are in the open sea that never really stop, they do keep swimming, but there was some footage where a white shark was in I think the East Coast off of Cape Cod, and it went down to the bottom and it just sat there for a little while on the bottom.
Oh.
But I imagine there was some current running through there or whatever. But then I imagine they can rest and stuff like that. But we don't really see them ever do anything other than just keep moving forward.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting to think about. Just imagine if you had to always be moving forward your whole life and you can never really stop and look at anything.
Wow. Yeah. Relentless forward progress.
Yeah, you walk up to the, you know, takeout window and you just keep moving by, and then next time you come by, maybe there's stuff there.
That is interesting. Go ahead, Dallas.
Oh, no, nothing. I was going to say, we already talked a little bit just about the young. And, you know, the most common question that we get out here on Tamales Bay as kayakers is that, you know, a lot of people hear that Tamales Bay is a breeding ground for the white sharks.
Oh, yeah.
How accurate is that?
It's a really interesting it's a really interesting urban myth. And it's been around since I was a kid. And, you know, back then, people actually, I think, believed it because, to a certain extent, if you heard about any fishermen catching white shark, it would be, you know, out there a lot of times off at Tamales Point, they were fishing with tramble nets. And then divers, specifically divers, were being attacked off of Tamales more than anywhere else in the world. So it really earned its reputation, but it wasn't the right premise that it's a breeding ground. Yeah. Now, there's lots of different sharks that are in the bay, and they're smaller, and I could see how somebody could come up with that, but I'm just amazed at how it stuck.
Oh, for sure. I mean, as a kayak guide over the years,
I know.
even from people, surfers and people I think would know better, I would get that question a lot, you know?
Yeah.
It definitely is a pervasive myth.
Yeah, well, I've got...
Well, and you see a seven gill, too, in the water.
What's that?
I was going to say, you see a seven gill in the water out there, and you know, you're like, oh, that is a big shark, you know, or a thresher. So people, get, you know, they get their hairs on end, but, you know, not necessarily a white shark.
Well, back in the day, apparently they, off of, you know, Teacher's Beach or wherever they were doing their swimming lessons, at times they would have somebody in a boat with a gun.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
My goodness.
Oh, my word.
Yeah, somewhere there's an old picture of that, so.
Wow. Well, and that brings me to a question, and not to freak people out that spend time on Tamales Bay, but how often do they come in Tamales Bay?
Almost never, really.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, we even put a receiver inside the bay when we had quite a few of them tagged, and we put one on that green buoy that's right down there by Lawson's, and then one over by the seal colony. Further up, there's a haul out there of or harbor seals. Anyway, there was one detection, I think, maybe two at the green can, which means the shark was, you know, over the bar. And the guys that spearfish for halibut there, they see them from time to time. I don't know why they continue to go out there, but I wouldn't want to see one. Not in that way, anyway. So basically, they never were picked up on the receiver that was further in the bay yet. Now, that's not to say they won't come in the bay.
Right. There's no fence.
And there was a pretty good, and almost everything that's out in the ocean has ended up in this bay. So it's there's something pretty unique about it. And then, I don't know, there was a pretty good report off of Marshall a couple of years ago that somebody early morning heard some noise and looked over and they saw the shark take a seal down. And then
they described
seeing the head, the dorsal fin, and the tail, which if I hear that, that sounds pretty good to me because that's how they come up their head. Yeah. So just the description alone made it sound kind of real, and I could imagine that. But then again, the water's pretty murky in the bay. And
I was going to ask, what deter them from coming in the bay? Because, I mean, obviously there's a hardy harbor seal population, but is it the murkiness of the water, the salinity level, the temperature?
I think it's
shallow depth of the entry.
Yeah, it's probably, one, they probably don't like to be in confined spaces, you know, with current and stuff like that. They probably don't, they can get stranded, you know, if they're in the shallows. So that's possible. But, again, it's just they know the kind of spots they do hunt really well in, and that would be, you know, rocky headlands and, you know, Tamales Point, Point Reyes, all those places that have large numbers of seals and sea lions near shore, but also, you know, they could sneak around over these rocky bottoms and come up over ledges and things like that. So they're really, it's the habitat that we find them in the most often. So
rocky headlands, huh?
Yeah, rocky headlands and
I know the mouth of Tamales Bay is nicknamed the shark. Is it, can it act as like a buffet line for some of these sharks?
Well, so it's really interesting with Tamales Point because originally I tried going there, and the first time didn't see anything. Second time we saw a boil. A boil is when a shark or something has come up underneath the decoy, and then they turn around, and the water kind of makes this welling up looks on the water, and you can see it pretty clearly. And if you know what it is, you know, it's pretty identifiable, and then sometimes you won't even see the shark. So they can be pretty...
Oh, wow.
They can be pretty wary. In fact, there are surfers that will see that, or fishermen, and they know what it is, but they never see the animal because by the time the thing has welled up, it's already gone away. But, you know, so I forgot what I was talking about that in the first place. What to get into the boils.
We were talking about the entrance of Tamales Bay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, right. So it's just, I'm sure they go in there from time to time. And so it's just not, there is another record of supposedly a bloodstain scene right off of the seal hall out there where I was telling you we put the receiver, but it wouldn't surprise me. And if you really wanted to see them come in the bay, what it would take, I think, is like a dead whale stranded on Hog Island or something like that. And then I think they'd probably swim right in there.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. And,
good to know.
Yeah, good to know.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, this area is part, like along the coast here, is part of the Red Triangle, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean? And where does that extend to exactly?
Yeah, so it should be called the White Shark Triangle, but because it's a sensational kind of thing, it's called the Red Triangle. And basically, it's a place that they kind of designated as a high likelihood of running into white sharks. And it spans from Año Nuevo, which is a huge colony of elephant seals down there, and quite a few sharks. Mm-hmm. If I was down there, I would be out there instead of up here. But and then it goes out to the Farallon Islands, and then it comes back in, I guess, around Jenner, I'm thinking. You could draw that line a lot of places. You could go to Tomales, but Bodega, there's sharks there, and all the way up into Jenner. So the idea is that there's a higher concentration. This would be like the hub of the population. But they range all the way down to, you know, Guadalupe Island, Mexico, all along the coast, all the way up into Oregon. So it's
I was going to ask about their range. Exactly.
Yeah. It's pretty far range. Mainly along the coast. They go offshore, which is a whole other subject. But when they're here on the coast, they pretty much stay within a mile or two of the coast, because that's their habitat, looking for seals and sea lions along the coast. So, and so what you could do if you really wanted to, like, assess a place for whether it was dangerous to go out or not, is you first look at the history. Mm-hmm. Nuevo has already had a couple people attack on kayaks there, so that wouldn't be too good. And so you could sort of, like, come up with a methodology where you could also look at, are there seals and sea lions in the area? Is the bottom drop off quickly? How deep of water would you be in, and how far away from any kind of shore or landing or some place where you could get out of the water or get to help? Sometimes that's a really important thing to think about, because if your boat's disabled, let's say you have a inflatable boat and it's disabled, you're not going anywhere. So,
right.
Yeah,
that'd be a little disconcerting if there was a shark interested in you. But
yeah, and we did see
one more reason not to use inflatable boats.
Yeah, I would say especially ocean kayaking around here. Yeah, that's
definitely. So, kind of tangent from the White Shark Triangle, there's the White Shark Cafe, and when we were researching for the trip, your satellite tags that you were using at Stanford helped discover that?
Yep, absolutely. We put the first tags on that discovered that, period. At the island there, we were given one tag, and that tag didn't work, and then we were given another tag. We put that one on, and that one actually was on for a month and then came off as shark right off of Tomales Point, surprise. And we actually got that tag back, and we were able to look at the data, and it was kind of surprising to see how much vertical movement they do, up and down, lots and lots of up and down, going up and looking at something and then back down, and staying relatively shallow most of the time, you know, near shore. So then we finally had a tag that stayed on all the way out to the cafe, which is this place. If you drew a line between Hawaii and Baja and you went to the middle of that line and then you put a circle there the size of New Mexico, that's where they go. And why they go there is a debate, but personally, I think it has to do with breeding.
Right.
And so that's a longer subject. But, they do this migration, and it was totally unknown. And so that was a discovery. And since then, you know, they've put more tags on, and they pretty much duplicate the same thing. The males are very predictable in that they come here, and then they go back out there, and then they come back to the same spot, and then they go back out there. The females tend to deviate from this pattern. And it probably has something to do with their life history that nobody knows about yet. And years ago, I asked John McCosker, how come no one had ever caught a pregnant female in California? And he said, well, because they're somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right. Couldn't come up with that myself, but yeah. So they have a different pattern. It hasn't really been figured out 100% yet, but it is very possible that they spend more time way offshore and less time on the coast.
Gotcha.
But they do, the one thing, they do give birth down in Southern California around the Channel Islands and into Baja. So when they do come to the coast or whatever, they have to go there to give birth. So.
Oh, okay. So they're giving birth close to shore.
Yes.
But most likely the shark cafes is an area where they mate.
I believe so, yeah. In that when they show up here after being out there, they're usually thin. And when they leave here, they're usually heavier, a lot heavier. And so there's got to be less food out there, at least from our observations. And then, you know, why else would they go way out there? And so there's a couple strategies with breeding sharks. So one strategy with some sharks is that they can breed, they can mate with like several males, a bunch of males, five males or something, and their offspring showed diverse genetics from that. And then some sharks, they only breed with one animal, and one, let's say the female breeds with one male, and then no more, and all those young are the same, have the same genealogy. So what ends up happening is, let's just imagine you were a big white shark and you were out there at the cafe wanting to breed. Well, do you want to swim around in a way that all the males know where you are and they all start following you around? And then you literally could be harassed to the point where it could be deadly. They bite the females on the head and pectoral fin when they're mating, and it does leave quite a bit of a, you know, damage on that animal. Yeah. Now, the females are bigger than the males, and we do see males with these massive bites, and so there's a good chance that the female doesn't want to breed. She just turns around and just bites them, and they go away.
Oh, wow.
That's kind of like – this is all speculation, by the way.
I was going to ask. So one burning question I have, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember from your presentation it was said that white sharks have never been seen mating. Is that accurate?
It's probably accurate. There is one account of somebody in like New Zealand or something said they saw two sharks on the bottom, and it looked like they were mating. But you know, there's no documentation of it, so
okay. It's
just another story, unfortunately.
Right.
But yeah, it'd be, you know, that's like the Holy Grail. Anybody that figures that out even could confidently say this is what they were doing here, and then, you know, that would be pretty impressive. But it's, you know, they go in this really, really remote part of the ocean. There isn't really anywhere more remote. And so my theory is that they go through these diving patterns. And so my idea is that, let's say you're trying to find something out in the middle of the ocean. You've got three dimensions, you know. Mm-hmm. Let's say there's an olfactory sense to it, whether the females become receptive and they give off some kind of a hormone or something that they can pick up on, you know, animals can smell it or whatever. So there's a way of attracting other males or whatever. But if, you know, like I said, if a bunch of males were to get the female at the same time, it could kill her even. So to minimize that, they probably avoid males in general. And when they finally find one that they want to mate with, they mate, and then that's it. So does that make sense?
I mean, I think so. Yeah.
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 All right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the West Marin Natural on KWMR, 90.5 Point Reyes Station, 89.9 Bolinas, and 92.3 in the San Geronimo Valley. And we are playing an episode that initially aired back in December of 2022 with Scott Anderson from the California White Shark Project. And so this episode has been excellent to re-listen to. And California White Shark Project is still going strong, and they have a couple events coming up soon. One of them is on October 8th at the Hook Fish Company, in Mill Valley, from 6 to 9 p.m., and that's a fundraiser. And then there's the Sharktacular over in Half Moon Bay with Surf Rider Foundation of San Mateo County and the California White Shark Project. They have an event going on down there on October 16th from 6 to 8 p.m.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. Hoping we're going to be able to make it to one or both of those. Also, KWMR is underwritten by Where Are We? Cleaner California Coast, a Leave No Trace initiative working to make Marin, Sonoma, and Mendocino coastlines healthier through community education. More information at cleanercoast.org. And that is in collaboration with the Environmental Action Committee of West Marin. And they have the Piper on the Ridge coming up on October 5th. So if you haven't got your tickets to that, it's a sliding scale kind of donation-based type of thing where we go listen to bagpipes and be in community and watch the sun set and the full moon rise.
It's so much fun.
It's a really sweet, sweet event. So we'll be there. Hopefully we'll see some of you there. And
back to the show.
Back to the show.
They basically go to a place where they're not going to get mobbed, I think.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's just literally like the middle of nowhere in the ocean.
Yeah, so if you went to Año Nuevo this time of year and they'll say they were breeding, you'd males and females, and I don't know how that would go down, but it would be different.
And so in terms of
we have a lot more data about that, I feel like. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
What's that?
I was just saying we'd have a lot more data about that. If that's what they were doing out there in these large numbers,
right?
There'd be more like evidence,
yes,
right? You would think,
yeah,
because
so,
it's so close
okay,
to shore and it's easier to get to and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so the other thing is that the mating scars on the female are really distinctive. There's impressions on the head and then sometimes on the pectoral fin, but they're they're not like big bites. They're sort of they're soft bites for a shark, if you could imagine that. And so they leave these very distinctive impressions. And when we see them on the sharks, on the females, they're either partially healed or completely healed. We've never seen one show up without them and then end up getting them. So there's really no evidence that they would be breeding here. And plus, it'd be distracting, you know. If everybody was breeding and eating and feeding.
So, and then one thing that...
like a lot, yeah.
For sure. One thing I was curious to clarify, in the Shark Cafe, I mean, you have the Pacific population, like out here on the West Coast, and then there's, over where Dallas and Liz are right now, there's a Hawaiian population, right?
The Hawaiian population is probably the same as... Well, it is the same as this population.
Oh, it is? Oh,
yeah, so this population extends out to Hawaii, and a little bit beyond, and so there's two areas that they aggregate in out there, the cafe, and then beyond Hawaii is the second place. But they, it's a big area again, and the islands do kind of attract things, and so we've actually had quite a few records now that people have seen a white shark in Hawaii, videoed it, and sure enough, we recognize it. So,
oh, okay,
it is the same group of animals.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. Yeah, for some reason I had in my head that it was a separate population.
No, they're the same. And so you just think of that cafe as just expanding up into that area. And then, you know, the population in Japan is genetically different. And then as you go around the world, they're all different. So.
Oh, okay. And so a lot of the different populations around the world, they're not necessarily sharing genetics.
Yeah, they're different, but there's enough difference that you can tell they're genetically isolated, but they're all the same.
Right.
But,
gotcha.
Yeah. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. And you can tell the individuals by the dorsal, correct?
Yes, that's how.
And then other markings. Kind of
what's that? What?
I'm sorry, and some of the other markings and scum as well.
Yes. That was the first thing that we noticed, that we could recognize scars and things like that on them. And then once we got a few pictures of the dorsal fin, it was like, okay, well, the dorsal fin, the reason why the dorsal fin is so good is that it has this tattered edge to it, the back end. And sometimes it's very smooth, but there's just one little nick or something like that. But if you take a picture of it from either side, it's the same silhouette. So like the scars and stuff you see on them are maybe it's on the left side, and if you only saw that shark on the right side, you wouldn't know. And so the dorsal fin lends itself to being, you know, taking a picture of from either side, and it really helps.
Oh, interesting. Well,
and you have quite the catalog of dorsal fins.
It's now overwhelming for me anyway, because, you know, I've been doing it for so long. I used to know all the sharks that were kind of the local yokels or whatever, and now it's Paul's much quicker at picking up on them.
And this is a topic I definitely want to get into here, but we do need to take a quick break.
Oh, yeah.
And also, we're gonna, and we got a nice little shark song that we found together by National Geographic.
We wanted to keep it positive.
Yeah, yeah. Keep it positive and happy.
But quick message I also have to mention from a place that is called the Palace Market. the Palace Market is downtown in Point Reyes Station. Information at palacemarket.com. That's palacemarket.com. And here is a little song, and we'll be back in a few minutes.
If you find yourself nose to nose with a great white man-eating shark, the thing to do is to leave the water quietly, just as if your only thought was to rub in more suntan lotion.
If I was a great white shark, I wouldn't bite you. If I was a great white, I wouldn't bite you, but I'd swim right next to you. If I was a great white, I wouldn't bite you, but I'd swim right next to you and ask you how you do. Then you look at me and pull out a harpoon and try to shoot me. Then I'd realize how kind of really hungry I am right now. Sorry about your leg, I'll be back in a while for the rest. Don't stress, my sister will be back to clean up this mess. Relax, kick back, it's only a great white shark attack. Rah! If I was a great white, I wouldn't bite you, but I'd swim right next to you. If I was a great white, I wouldn't bite you, but I'd swim right next to you, cause sharks like surfing too. You paddle out chasing the fat sets and pushing the sunset. Then I'd realize I've never seen a seal so fat and slow. Sorry about your arm, I just didn't know. Think fast, swim back, you still look like a seal. Your wetsuit's so black and red. Great white sharks dive 4,000 feet, swim across the world. Damn, isn't that deep? 40 million years, and they haven't changed. Apex predator survival.
Pretty good.
That was pretty funny. You know, nothing about a positive song about shark attacks.
Yeah.
So
I think Dallas and I had a different song in mind, but that's okay.
Well, I'm saying it's been so hard to find positive songs, but or even trying to find a song that said just without the great white shark.
Yeah,
about right. White sharks.
Yeah, and they do get a bad rap that is sometimes unnecessary.
They really do. I have a very controversial opinion. You know, I actually think white sharks are extremely cute. I love their smiles.
Yeah, they can smile.
They do have a good smile. Yeah, we were
California.
Talking a little bit of
go ahead,
about that.
Well,
California's
always had a pretty progressive attitude about its white sharks, and so whereas other places right. in the world they put out bounties if someone got attacked and you know kill the sharks and all that. I grew up as working as a deckhand during Jaws, and you know it was like you catch a shark and everybody just wanted to kill it, and so in the long run that actually ended up. Turning on itself because enough people got tired of that kind of attitude and divers started, you know, seeing them and stuff like that. And so now they're totally on the other end of the spectrum and every little kid wants to have a t-shirt with a white shark on it and stuff like that.
Yay!
Little baby shark yeah. song, which we really did not want to play, but was the only positive shark song out there. talking a little bit about the age, I was looking at, on your social media. There was a post about Yvonne Chouinard, who was mm-hmm. estimated to be 75 plus years old.
Yeah. So what we came to years ago, before there was any data on this, was is that they had to be an old, long-lived creature, especially when you see some of these really, really big ones.
Right.
They just, you can't imagine, you know, something like that living 20 years and getting through a whole, all that, you know, all that sneakiness, and, you know, they're really well-adapted and stuff like that, but they just really, a lot of what they do is learned. It's the same thing. They all do it, but it's basically, you know, they have a have to survive in the North Pacific. It's not easy. So they finally were able. So if you look at salmon shark vertebrae and you section them, cut them in half, and look at them, you can see the bands, the rings on the vertebrae, just like rings on a tree, and you can age them up to, like, I think 28 years or something like that. So they live a long time. But it's laborious to do that, and what happens is as they get bigger, they grow slower, and the rings are harder to find. So on white sharks, it becomes, once they get to a certain point in their growth, it's so slow that the rings are indistinguishable. So there's this thing that happened in the world when they set out these tests of the atomic bombs in different places around the world, and each one of those left a signature that's definable or whatever on everything on Earth.
What?
Whoa.
Whoa.
Yeah. So what they had to do was they went back and found some jaws that were taken from some sharks with a known date of capture, and they had the, you know, size of the shark and all that kind of information, and then they found these signatures of these bombs in those vertebrae at a certain point, and they were able to extrapolate back to seeing that the sharks were 60, 70 years old.
Oh my
gosh.
So
one of them was over 70 years old.
What do you mean by signature exactly? Like, how does...
It's
like a radiation, like, signature?
Yep, that's it. Kind of scary.
That is...
That is scary.
Crazy.
Yeah, but that's how they did it. So it's, for people that are really science-minded, you could look the paper up. But, I think it was produced by Greg Skolmel. But the main thing is that it's impressive information. And we kind of, like I say, always had an idea they were long-lived, and now it's looking like they could well live over 100 years, easy, probably.
Well,
yeah.
What are some of their biggest threats? And I know, like, on the Pacific, their population is doing pretty well out here, right? I guess
yes.
It probably correlates with the seal population.
We're not seeing any decline, which is good. There's a lot of sightings of these smaller sharks now. That are mainly kind of moving north because of, you know, the changing temperature of the ocean, basically.
Okay.
But, yeah, their population seems to be not declining, so that's great.
That is good. Well, I mean, they've always – so I know they're an apex predator, but they've had some interesting interactions with, like, orca whales, yeah?
Yeah. So the orca is probably the number one threat to them in – nature. So orcas definitely kill white sharks. They suck their liver out and eat the liver and leave the rest. And so it's a pretty sophisticated attack. But it first occurred at the Farallones back in 95, and you know, if this project hadn't have been going back then, it never would have been really identified, because no one would have been there to document it like they did. So the thing is that it's now, so on that day when it happened, I was there, and I got on the island, and I was like, well, we might as well call the season. That's it. You know, what else are we going to see now? And sure enough, all the sharks were gone. And so they had all left. And so I stayed 2 weeks, and then I got out of there and found some off of Tomales and stuff like that. But they were gone, and they weren't coming back. So it was pretty dramatic thing, quite, you know, unique. And so I kind of figured it was going to happen again. Some people asked me, do you think it's going to happen again? I said, yeah, it's going to happen again. It was way too sophisticated,
yeah,
the way they just suck the liver out and all that. So anyway, sure enough, it's been documented now in South Africa, and I don't know if it's other places, but orcas will come in, kill a white shark, and all the other ones will leave the area. So
I don't blame them.
Yeah.
The other threats that remain for white sharks are still fisheries, entanglement, right, things like that, especially when they leave our coast. There's no protection offshore. They're protected in California, but they're not protected out in the open ocean. And then there's also a surprising amount of boat strikes, which I kind of find almost hard to believe, but once I kind of looked into it more, it's starting to pan out as being a really likely scenario that happens mostly to the younger, smaller animals. And being small, they're more likely to lose body temperature because they're not that gigantotherm or endotherm like they are the big ones. Because they're just like little kids turn purple if there's no water for very long.
Right.
So they don't have the same ability to stay warm. So they stay a lot longer at the surface during the daytime when it's warm. And people are bombing along in their boats up and down the coast, and that's the same habitat. And so we've seen in 2017, there was two or three that washed up dead from these boat strikes. And that's just probably a fraction of what actually has been hit and died because they sink. So it's an unknown number, but we have, you know, lots of pictures of sharks with boat strikes. It's usually right across the middle of the back. And it's usually on these smaller sharks.
So. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and then I'm trying to think if there's any. Well, there's all the same threats that everything is threatened by in off the coast, but you really have a lot of protections in California and to the north and south. So it's pretty good.
Nice.
This part of the coast, anyway.
I do find it interesting that you said the population slowly shifting north with changes in the water. So that's mainly the younger sharks, you said?
Yeah, so that's where it's been identified, and I think that's going to be something that probably just be a trend. If you look at the larger individuals, they're here for the seals, and they can tolerate a wider range of water temperature because of their size.
Okay.
So unless the seals start to move north, they're still going to be around here. That's my prediction anyway. But if the seals start shifting north as well, they'll just shift with them.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I want to.
Well. Yeah.
I said I want to. Go ahead, Liz.
That's all right. Yeah. That was tough. So the monitoring of the sharks and gathering all this data. I wanted to talk about your project, the California White Shark Project, and why that was created and why it's important and all of that, because we are getting towards the end of the show.
Great minds think alike. That's exactly where I was planning on going. So.
Yeah.
Well, good. We're all on the same page. Yeah. So, you know, this project started when I was a bird bander back in 1987. And, you know, I had a unique set of skills being, you know, growing up on the water and fishing a lot and looking for birds and things in the water. And I also, you know, tagged fish when I was a kid and was very familiar with all the science that had been known at that time, up to that time, about white sharks. And so when I got to the island, you know, it was in September, and I met Phil Henderson, and he started talking about the sharks. And, you know, I knew all the people and all the information that was known up to that point. So he said that, you know, someone's probably going to see an attack in the 2 weeks I was going to be there, but it probably wouldn't be me. And I was like, well, it's going to be me, you know. So I spent a lot of time looking. And then I was seeing them on a daily basis, and they were like, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I've been looking. So that's how it started. It was just sort of a lucky thing for me to be there at the same time. Hmm. But so since then, you know, the project has gone through, it went from, you know, working for PRBO as a volunteer to Hopkins Marine Station was paying for the tags and our efforts. Then it went to the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and then COVID killed the Monterey Bay Aquarium thing. And Paul and I were actually pretty frustrated working for the aquarium. I know it sounds hard to believe, like if people heard you worked for the aquarium, it's like, oh my God, that's so great. Well, it wasn't so great actually, because they're a corporation, and we got hired every year as a seasonal, like somebody that just came off the street, you know, but we had all this very specific kinds of skills that made our work possible safely and years of experience. So we really, once we got dropped by the aquarium, it was a kind of a relief for me. And I just kept thinking how easy it would be for us to just do it on our own. But how do you do that? You know, it's just so hard to find the resources for that. So Paul And I talked about it, and he finally decided that we should try developing this nonprofit. And so the nonprofit is really designed in a way that would just keep the project going. And so we have this really long data set that goes back to 1987. And, you know, to restart that, you'd have to put in 30-plus years.
Yeah. Oh, that's got to be invaluable.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So the responsibility is kind of like, well, I can't just walk away from this thing. And Paul's really into it. And so if we can just generate enough funds to support the project, and Paul and myself, then we can get this done for less money in the long run and have much more control over things like even just this right now, giving out information about what we're learning is something that didn't come that easily like it is now with the aquarium. I mean, who would you call over there? Where would you go to ask a question? So this is now it's, I kind of think of it as the people's project in a way.
Totally.
Yeah.
Is it the longest survey of white? Do you have the longest survey of white sharks in the world?
Yeah, actually, especially if you look at just the Farallon Islands, it goes back to 1987. Haven't missed a fall out there. We've had some years where it was really well. The year that the orca came in there, we didn't see any more sharks. So each year, each season's been a little bit different. But yeah, a continuous record like that's pretty hard to beat.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, and it, like Liz mentioned, it has come up a lot on our show when we've had researchers on, like how important like long term data is, that give you a sense of what, much better sense of what's going on as opposed to like a couple years.
Exactly. Yeah, so we have a lot of records now of sharks that we've seen over 20 years, and it just gets more interesting as time goes on. So,
yeah, you said it's hard to keep track of the sharks these days, huh?
Yeah. Well, it's so bad. The other thing is that there are other groups of people that are doing the same thing in other places. And so if you start looking at all these dorsal fins and stuff, it gets pretty confusing. So really what would be the best thing for everybody to do is just keep the same kind of catalog, which already isn't happening, but most people are. So there's another group that they don't use the dorsal fin. They use like the black and white pattern on the side of the shark, but they have to get six different places, the gills, the tail, and then the side, and on both sides of each animal. So it's really hard to do.
Huh, interesting. Right.
And it's a lot harder to look at the stuff because you got to look at all these six places instead of just one thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You know, I remember back at your presentation, and we will probably have too much time to talk about this, but there sounds like there's a lot of challenges for actually tagging and like tracking sharks. It's not an easy feat.
No, it's not. And that's one of the things that's so great about the dorsal fin. If you think about it, it's like a tag. The first picture you take of it is the tag, and then every time you see it after that, it's a recapture. And so you couldn't ask for a better thing because, you know, it's right there. You just have to get a picture of it. It doesn't hurt the shark to take a picture of it. The external tags that we used to put on, especially spaghetti tags in the beginning, they just are a dart, you know, and they pulled out relatively quickly, actually, over time. And then there's no record anymore, so you lose that record.
Oh, yeah.
Really, the dorsal fin being used as, like, the tag or the marker, and then subsequently, if you tag them with an acoustic tag or a satellite tag, you know the individual that actually took that tag for a ride. And some of these sharks have been tagged, you know, four or five times with PAT tags, which are the satellite tags. So it becomes a really deep data set that you can't really get with a lot of animals, especially in the marine environment.
Hmm. Is when you tag them, is it able to track how deep they can go?
Yeah.
Or yeah?
Yeah, so there's two kinds of tags that have been being used. Acoustic tags need a receiver, something in place to listen for the shark's tag. So if you put a tag on one, you have to put something in the water to listen for it. But if you have three or four listening stations like they do down at Onion Nuevo, and there is one at Trellis, which doesn't work. You can go online and look and see if the sharks are there or not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so those are acoustic tags. But the other ones are the satellite tags, and those are like a mini computer that record things like depth, water temperature, daylight, things like that. And they stay on the shark for a certain amount of time, and then they pop off and download data. But if you get the tag back, you get every single data point. So there's pretty rich data there.
Wow.
So the two kinds of tags, with the dorsal fin as a, you know, individual marker, it's pretty sophisticated research. I mean, it's right up there with, you know, researchers in Kenya or whatever studying lions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the research here in California White Shark Project being so new, what are some current needs you guys are having right now, or ways that people could help?
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you for that. That's really important. I was basically, the last 3 years, Paul and I have been working at a deficit, you know, kind of out of pocket. We've gotten by with the GoFundMe thing, and we've gotten a lot of local support, and it's incredible to see how much local support we get. And that needs to continue, and we're out here working on it today. But in the future, you know, we need to reach a larger audience so that we can fund this thing better. So we've been working with Maxine, and she's our social media person. McBessel was her last name. And so she's been actually doing this Instagram thing. And so there's followers from other parts of the world that are still checking in with us. And
oh, cool.
It's exciting to see that people are, you know, interested in what we're doing here in other places. So.
And how can people find you to fund you?
Yeah, so it's the California White Shark Project. You just Google it and go to the website, and there's a donate button there you could push, or and you could just check in with this website anytime and get information about, you know, what we're doing. The season is always in the fall into winter, so there'll be updates like every couple of weeks during that time of year.
That's when sharks are kind of more prevalent out here, right?
Yeah, they pretty much show up in late July and August, and they pretty much leave by January, February. And go out to the place we were talking about.
Yeah.
Way out
back, back to the cafe.
Yeah.
Some of the footage that you guys had on your social media coming out this year was really amazing. Everybody should check it out.
Absolutely.
Because we were doing that for the research for the show. And yeah, some of that footage is just incredible.
It's a lot of fun. You know, it's great footage. So.
All right. If you're just tuning in, that was our show from December 12th, 2022 with the California White Shark Project, and they are still going strong.
They sure are. Yeah, and they actually have two upcoming events if you want to come out there and learn more. It's October 8th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Mill Valley at Hookfish Company, and there they're going to have the raffle prizes. I believe we actually you can win two spots from Point Reyes Adventure Company with Liz and I for a tour.
You sure can.
And then the next one is going to be on October 16th at Half Moon Bay Yacht Club from 6 to 8 p.m. in Half Moon Bay. So thank you all for listening, and I hope you have a great day.
See you in a couple weeks.